Hometown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and comics. And I'm Thor.
I'm Brian.
And today we are going to be looking at Special Forces by Kyle Baker and Potter's Field by Mark Waid and Paul Azaceta. We'll start with Special Forces by Kyle Baker. And the overall plot is about a unit of Marines. Is that right?
I don't know. The Marines, Army.
Military. They go to the Iraq War, and it starts out with them just getting their unit just getting blown to hell right from the beginning. And I guess the basic overall arc is about this recruiter that has to recruit a quota or else he'll get sent back to the front.
Yeah. Right.
Into a battle zone. And so he just starts recruiting anybody so that he doesn't have to go back, and he misses his quota barely.
Right.
And ends up going back and commanding the unit that he recruits. And so he ends up recruiting felons and essentially, I think one of them's autistic, right? And so this is kind of their story as they go in. But right off the bat, you can see that it's not going to be a very realistic view of war in general or of the Iraq War.
Yeah, you know, I think that it tries really hard to point out the cliches, because the very first page is a full page of a guy getting his head blown off, and first words are, the black guy dies first.
Yeah.
Which is the total cliche. I mean, the only thing you could have done more cliche is have him, you know, talking about his wife and kids back home.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and showing pictures to everybody. I mean, you know that guy is gonna die.
Or saying something like, I'm retiring in a week.
Right, exactly. You know, this is my last patrol, and then I'm going home. Yeah, so, you know, Baker is really trying on the one hand to point out that, you know, all the cliches here are, you know, he's gonna point them out and go, here's a cliche, you know, and wait, and then you turn the page, and it is a, you know, double page spread of a massive explosion. And this is when you start to see what Baker's trying here, because half the page is this female soldier's, you know, ass in your face in short shorts. So you kind of have this juxtaposition of the violence and the war with this sort of cheesecake shot going on too. And you know, that's sort of what he's trying to do, I think, in this, is juxtapose what you think war is, or all the cliches of war, with all this crazy, outrageous stuff that he's putting in here as well. So that it's, you know, not a real look at war, it's a look at what he wants you to look at in war.
Sure. I just saw it as this overly sexy woman who has ripped off short shorts, like hot pants, and this halter top that somehow is covering her breasts, but I have no idea how it's staying there. And as you go through the book, more and more of it gets ripped off or shredded until it's basically just covering her nipples by the end.
Right. And, you know, and that's the thing, is it really did take me a while, you know, multiple readings, honestly, to try to suss out what he was trying to do with the characters here and what he was trying to do with the whole situation, because it is so jarring and so unrealistic that it pulls you out of the war story. And I'm not sure if that's what he was trying to do, if he was trying to pull everybody out of the war story and say, pay attention to this, this, and this, or what his whole point was. But, you know, clearly he was trying to say, you know, this is something different, you know, and this is not your typical war story. I'm just not sure that, you know, it was really, you know, working out that well.
It didn't work with me. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he gets to the point where you have a mutant child speaking telepathically, yeah. I was like, all right, you, he completely, I don't know, I was completely turned off. Well, by that point.
Let's rewind. Let's talk about the characters here, you know, and start with that, because, you know, the mutant children come in later on in it. And again, I think I know what he was going for here. And you're right. It was really out there. The story focuses really on two characters. And in perfect, you know, war cliche fashion, we don't ever know their names. They're nicknames.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got Felony and Zone. And Felony is the girl in the short shorts and barely contained top. And she's got the name Felony because basically she had the option of, you know, this being her third strike, you know, so she could either go to prison for a very long time or she could go and join the army. So mm-hmm. she goes and joins the army. Zone is an autistic guy who... got coerced and talked into this, you know, volunteering for the army, and he was talked into it basically because he was promised friends, and he excels at military life because of the routine and the day in, day out, just, you know, regimen of it all. And part, you know, he's given a list every day of everything he is to do, and he follows that list to a T.
Sure. And I think that that's how this book was sold to me, on this premise, mm-hmm. and I found that an interesting idea, but I felt like that was almost a side note to this actual story right. of this book, and I found that to be really lacking. That's what I really wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
Was this interesting idea of this autistic guy just going through his list and trying to follow it to a T.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the mission gets completely screwed up and he's still on that, I was really interested in that idea. And I feel like that was completely hijacked by this Felony character, and who I didn't find interesting at all.
Yeah, the Felony character really took over. And it's interesting because the genesis for this story, the genesis for Special Forces, is with Zone, actually. Zone is based, albeit loosely, on a guy from Portland, Oregon, who was recruited for a four-year term, I think, as an Army Ranger or an Army Scout. I mean, a very, very dangerous position. And he was mildly autistic. And the family threw a huge fit about it. And the Army's response was that he passed all their tests. That he did everything they asked of him, and that he, you know, their intelligence tests, their, you know, and really his ability to follow orders and pass the physical and all these things. So they didn't really see the problem. And what later came out was that, you know, the military was under huge pressure to meet their recruiting goals because they hadn't met them in the previous year. The recruitment goals had actually been lowered substantially, and they were in danger of not meeting them again. And so there was a lot of pressure on them. It led to a huge investigation. Several people were demoted and all sorts of things as a result of it. And so that was kind of the genesis of the Special Forces story.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think that seeing it, you know, you want to follow Zone, but Zone doesn't speak in this story at all. And so following Zone, I think, would be a really tough challenge without having somebody like Felony, who's all mouth, you know, telling the story and pointing all this stuff out.
I felt, though, that was a cliche. That's a cliche of the buddy pick, you know, the buddy picture where one guy's the smart mouth, you know, break all the rules type, and then the other's the, you know, follow the rules and, you know, stay quiet type.
Right.
And so I felt like that was totally cliche.
Right. You know, and like I said, there's, you know, on the one hand, there are parts in this where Baker just embraces the cliche. I mean, really just embraces the whole, you know, two people left on the mission, you know, and against all odds type thing. Where, you know, and then there are other times where he's just, like I said, just throwing the finger to the cliche.
Sure.
You brought up the mutant children talking through telepathy. There is a scene in the book where Zone and Felony have been captured. And we don't know what happened to Zone. Zone is somewhere. And Felony is tied down. And again, this brings us to, you know, another one of those, I'm going to stick it in your face here, that I'm toying with sex and violence. There's a double page spread of her tied down in a very bondage position. You know, and I'm talking in the sexual terms of bondage, not the, you know, prisoner type. And she's surrounded by these just horribly disfigured mutant children, all pointing various weapons at her.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that scene really stuck out at me. It's just, you know, being that scene where everything goes completely off the rails. And because it is, I mean, everything you can somehow logically in the back of your mind up until that point, logically figure out some way that all this could exist.
Sure.
But once you get to the mutant children, that's where your brain just is like, okay, hang on, stop. And that's where it started to make sense for me what Baker was trying to do in that scene. Baker was, the way I understand it, trying to point out, you know, make everything so grotesque and so bizarre so that the truly crazy real facts about the war would be completely believable. That things that, you know, if you were just told about them, you'd go, no, I don't know. But when they're couched in terms of, well, the alternative is this, then this doesn't seem so crazy and out there. So with the kids, you know, these kids are horribly disfigured, and what you get is you get this whole thing about, you know, the children telling her, that so many of them were disfigured by unexploded ordinances.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that the kids were playing with it is these ordinances are bright yellow. That, you know, they look like toys. And they're just littering the ground there. And then what do? You write comic books with superheroes saying, don't touch the explosives, don't touch the explosives. And, you know, what happens when you tell a kid not to do something? The first thing they do is go do it. So you've got, you know, you on the one hand, you're saying to yourself, well, kids would be smart enough not to. But, you know, wow, that, I guess it does kind of make sense. And then the whole mutation thing, there's a whole thing in here about some of these ordinances containing, was it depleted uranium? Wasn't that in there? Depleted uranium. So, while yes, these kids are, you know, becoming superhero type mutant things, the fact of the matter is that not only are there unexploded ordinances all over Iraq, but, you know, there's unexploded ordinances and exploded ordinances that contain depleted uranium, which are soaking into the groundwater and the food supplies there, causing all sorts of birth defects, which is how this kid came to be. I mean, he was you know, he was basically a big birth defect.
Sure.
So, by couching it in those terms, it's like, oh, okay, you know, then this doesn't, you know, all these other things seem almost reasonable. And there's other scenes in this book like that. You've got, you know, like I said, you've got Zone being recruited and being, you know, clearly autistic, clearly something, you know, not right about him. And then later on, you've got the thinly veiled Blackwater Corps, which I think they're called Greywater, you know, I mean,
sure.
Thinly veiled. And in the middle of this huge fight that's going on, they try to recruit Felony. And, you know, this battle's going on and all this stuff, and they're like, are you kidding? You know, she says, are you joking? And the Blackwater guy is saying, we ain't GI, baby. Lunch is in our contract. We can expense you. Let's see. Why not join a company that provides tuition assistance, free in-house management, free vocational training, free self-defense courses, highly competitive compensation, bonuses, and advancement opportunities, corporate sponsorship for employees to compete in regional and national athletic competitions, forested jogging tracks, open-air swimming areas, biking trails, an indoor cardio training center, and a weight training center. Don't forget weight management education, smoking cessation assistance, and company-provided basic family medical support, on-campus wind power generation, biodiesel vehicle design and development, biodiesel power plant design and development, an ecologically friendly 7,000-acre campus, employee-driven charitable community outreach programs, employee-driven national and international humanitarian support programs. Too good to be true? Well, there is a company that provides all this and much more. We're Greywater Worldwide. And this was after Felony had noted that the Greywater guys were better equipped than the soldiers were.
Yeah.
Had all the, you know, armor that was on back order for her. Their morale was through the roof, and they were getting the cush jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the soldiers were there also doing the fighting for far less money and under far worse conditions. So I think this was just Baker's way of pointing out that, you know, by pushing it so far beyond that, the stuff that in our real world seems so far out there, like, you know, Blackwater being such a great deal for the people that work there, and, you know, unexploded ordinances and autistic kids being, you know, recruited to the military, that doesn't seem so far out there all of a sudden.
Yeah, and I think that that's where it fails. I got all of that.
Uh-huh.
I think that that's where it fails. This should be the stuff that's shocking, but it's almost as an afterthought when you see her riding a fucking motorcycle up a statue of cross swords into a fucking helicopter.
Yeah.
That is a backstory to that. And I felt like what should be highlighted is the Blackwater story,
mm-hmm,
and the autistic and Felony stories. But it isn't. That's a backdrop to this. And it really doesn't hit hard. You read that and you're like, okay, you're moving on to the next page. It isn't paced for a maximum punch. It's almost as if it's an afterthought. What's paced for a maximum punch is all the action in this book. That's where I think it falls flat. And on top of that, I have several friends that have come back from the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this would be highly offensive to them, because the problems that they have is sleeping at night knowing what they've done to people,
mm-hmm,
to normal citizens, to people. And I think that this is highly offensive to those people that have trouble sleeping at night because they're morally conflicted about what they have done to humans.
Yeah, there really wasn't any of that. There was no remorse. It was everybody who was killed basically deserved to die. The only people that she had any... you know, conflict about were the children. Everybody else, you know, the
I think that that's one of the biggest problems that I have with this, is this book presupposes that these, all the people that they encounter deserve to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is one of the fundamental problems that Americans see with the rest of the world, is that we are superior and everybody else that disagrees with us deserves to die.
Mm-hmm.
I find that to be a fundamental problem with this book. And I have a hard time swallowing it because of that.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I certainly see, what you're saying here. And I don't know that that was Baker's point, and I don't know. I mean, because, yeah, I mean, this is definitely, there's good guys and there's bad guys in this. And the good guys are the Americans and the bad guys are everybody who isn't American. And yeah, I don't know. It would be interesting to know what Baker's politics are on this, because, it seems to be very pro-soldier, in the sense that the soldiers are, almost the tragic figures in this. It's like Zone wasn't supposed to be there.
Sure.
So I think he's trying to create something that's pro-soldier, but I think point about...
In the end, though, it makes a mockery of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because these soldiers don't come back feeling proud. And they don't feel like they're superheroes because they're not doing this stuff against, a Nazi who is clearly a bad person.
Right.
That's a clear evil intent, the Nazi, what the Nazis were trying to do. Whereas Iraq is much more gray, and the things that have happened is much more gray to a populist standpoint, mm-hmm. And so the people that I know that have come back have had serious problems dealing with that, and I feel like this book makes a mockery of that. As if, like, the soldier goes over there, and all they're doing is killing bad guys.
Yeah.
When the soldiers that come back know that's not true, and have a hard time dealing with that.
No, I agree. This was definitely a black and white, good versus evil mm-hmm. book.
And I think that that's where it fails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. I can really see that. I think he set out to make a very pro-soldier book, and instead ended up with something different.
Sure. And I mean, politics aside, like, I don't care about any of that. I'm here to read a comic book about a story. And I feel as though I'm not offended by the politics of it. Whether mm-hmm. it's pro-Bush or anti-Bush, I don't really care. I just feel that this was a book that was set up to do a service to a soldier's image. And I feel like it failed on that point fundamentally. And that's where I had the hugest problem with this story.
Should we switch to the art really quick?
Sure.
One of the things that I'm impressed with Kyle Baker, just as an artist, is that it's hard to pin him down to a style. There are several artists like, Mike Mignola, Dan Brereton, that you can look at something they've done and it's good, but you can automatically peg it as it's this person. Brereton is all about the face. You can tell a Dan Brereton face anywhere you go. Kyle Baker, his art is different from project to project to project. I mean, Special Forces does not look like Nat Turner, does not look like the Bakers. I mean, he's got several different styles. And I thought that the art in this book was striking. In many ways. I mean, we've talked about
definitely.
We've talked about the design of the characters and how it does and doesn't work in certain ways. But I thought that, he really has this laid out well, and he switches styles so dramatically. There's photo realism in this, basically where he's just taking photographs and messed with them in Photoshop. He's got hand drawn stuff. He's got bright colors, muted tones. He's got it looks like painted effects. I mean, the art in this is varied tremendously to great effect.
Yeah. I couldn't think of a book with a greater dichotomy between how much I liked the story and the art.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I absolutely hated this story and thought that the writing was terrible, but the art is amazing. And like you said, you know, following from page to page, it switches it up as the environment changes, and really to great effect, like you said, where you've got like the bright, almost neon colors on one page, and then you go to a muted effect on a different page when we're talking about the past and like the safety of the boot camp, you know, mm-hmm. where they're being trained, as opposed to like the bright neons and craziness of the actual battlefield. I feel like the art was hugely successful on this book in conveying what he was trying to convey.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things for me that was very striking was the use of, I don't know, shadow on faces, especially when we got to the Greywater people, and really not just the Greywater people, but the last quarter of the book, a lot of the characters as they, you know, become almost more animalistic.
Mm-hmm.
The Greywater people, the shadows around their faces make their faces look almost skull-like. And then as Zone and Felony move in deeper and deeper to go after their main target, there are several fight scenes where the characters are just in these deep shadows, and it takes on an otherworldly feel to them, that they're not necessarily living beings anymore. They're just, you know, animated bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, unfortunately is also how, you know, the military views its soldiers. I mean, for better or worse, at the end of the day, you know, the military cannot think of each individual soldier as a human being. And, you know, a soldier cannot think of the people that he or she is out there, you know, fighting. It can't think of them as human beings. I mean, I can't imagine what that would do to somebody.
Yeah.
You have to think of them as just numbers. And so to take them visually from being, you know, fully realized humans, you know, that you get at the very start of this, to these, you know, I mean, it is almost skeletal or, you know, animated corpses type look to them at the very end. It was sort of a shocking twist, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the art in this. I really did. And the coloring, one of my bad habits I have in books and magazines is when I get them, the first thing I do is I actually start at the back. Maybe it's because I'm left-handed. I don't know. I start at the back and I just sort of flip through.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed as I was flipping through that, you know, the coloring in the back is so different than the coloring in the front. And that was one of the things that I actually was wondering about was, you know, was there a switch in colorist along the way? You know, did something happen along the way? And then when I started to read the book, I said, no, this is a really natural progression along the way. And it was very deliberate and intentional.
Yeah, I agree. As the action ramps up in the book, so does the extremity of the coloring.
Right. And again, for impressive visual effect.
Uh-huh.
Which, you know, and I agree with you that the art on this book deserves to be judged separately from the story of the book. Like I said, I can see what he was going for.
Mm-hmm.
I really can. Like I said, I can see his intent in this. His intent was to be, you know, I believe was to be pro-soldier, and his intent was to point out just the absolute absurdities of what's going on over there.
I agree.
But I think it was a failure in doing so. And the art is good, but it doesn't carry this book.
Exactly.
You know, the other problem I had was the cost.
Yeah.
$17 for 4 issues. That brings us, you know, to what, $4.25 an issue.
Yep.
And you actually get less in this trade than if you would have bought the individual issues. There's no covers in this. The individual issues, at least I bought the first 2 issues when I was still buying floppies. They had essays or news releases. They had additional information in them. So, and the first issue I know was only $2.99. So, even if the other ones were, you know, $3.99 each, you're paying more money for less product.
Yeah.
And this is actually a smaller book. The size, the actual dimensions of the book are smaller than the original printed page. Yeah. So you're paying more for less physical book. And that was really frustrating for me because, you know, I don't know if they're just assuming that you're automatically going to get a deal on this, or this was designed really to go primarily to some place like Barnes & Noble or something like that, where there's, you know, people won't have picked up the individual issues. But I really felt like I was being gouged here.
Oh, definitely.
And it's, you know, it's the kind of thing where, again, I don't know what the quote-unquote added value on this is supposed to be.
I don't know. I mean, the paper quality is really nice. It does have, like, a nice paper quality, but I don't think that you can justify a $17 price tag for 4 issues.
No, I mean, that, like I said, and especially when the cover price on it was, you know, not that.
Yeah.
And this is not, I mean, while yes, I'm sure that the sales on the initial 4 issues probably indicate that not every comic shop in America carried it. You know, most comic shops in a fairly decent sized city will have this in back issues for roughly cover price. I mean, this is not a, you know, hard to find high priced back issue series.
Yeah.
So I really, you know, I don't know. If you're interested in this, skip the trade. Go and get the individual back issues from your local comic shop, or, you know, wait for this to come out on Amazon. I know that mine's going to be listed on Amazon here pretty soon. You can buy mine. I'll cut you a heck of a deal on it so that you don't have to pay the $17 price tag on it, because it just, I don't know. Baker's art is nice. It's impressive. The story, you know, like you said, it was an interesting concept. The execution just wasn't there.
Not to screw your sales, but I say skip the book entirely. I say it's not worth it.
Don't listen to Thor. I got to get some of my money back somehow here. So buy mine on Amazon and think for yourself which part you liked.
Okay, moving on, we have Potter's Field by Mark Waid and Paul Azaceta. And this is a story centering around one character, John Doe, who is completely mysterious. And his whole goal is, I guess there's this field, this is in New York, right?
Right.
Potter's Field, which is where all the unnamed victims of murders or
just unidentified bodies right,
go to this graveyard, and it's called Potter's Field. And his goal is to put names on these gravestones. And so this centers around his story and his search. And it's almost like a global frequency style story where you have the one character, John Doe, and then these other characters flitting in and out of the issues as they're needed. He has like a network of people in various professions that he pulls in as he needs to solve these most of them are murders.
Right, right. I saw it, you know, not just as the global frequency. Nice Warren Ellis reference, though. Thanks, I appreciate it. I saw it more as the Shadow, almost. You know, the old pulp character, the Shadow. Same kind of idea there, where you have this detective character who's steeped in mystery, and then, yes, he has a network of informants, some of whom are, high-placed police officers. John Doe has a coroner and a prison security guard and reporters and things, but also kind of the lower level, like people he's helped out, people just along the way who now, it's almost like blackmail in the one sense, because they
owe him one.
Yeah, they owe him one, and so they're helping him out. Some of them because they owe him one, and some because he's told them that they owe him one. But yeah, he's got this network.
But he also seems to have people that he's somewhat friends with, not really friends with, because nobody knows who he is or what he is. But there's people that he's opening up to through the book.
Right. And yeah, there were some nice characterization touches with that. Anytime you get the sort of, mystery man, it's very easy to fall into the cliches of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some really nice characterization points of this, because the mystery man just gets old pretty quick. It's like you want some answers. You can't continually have it, oh, he's the mystery man. And so there were nice little bits here and there, as Doe stops in at the coroner's office and he drinks a glass of water, and then sets it down. And then as soon as he leaves and shuts the door, the coroner goes over and dusts it for fingerprints, and there's none. And then the phone rings, and he picks up the phone, and it's Doe on the other end going, "You didn't think I'd be dumb enough to leave fingerprints, did you?" I mean, it's that kind of thing where there's little bits where you can see that, you don't get that just, oh, he's the man of mystery. Well, let's respect that. He, everyone's trying to figure out who he is, and he's aware of it, that even his friends and confidants are to some extent, digging behind him to try to figure it out, which I thought was a nice little twist.
Yeah, I enjoyed that too.
So, really, Potter's Field is designed, there's four issues here. And really, there's three stories. There's issue one, and then issue two and three are linked together, and then there's issue four. And issue one and issue four are really kind of self-contained stories. And I likened them to issues of Fell, my other Warren Ellis reference for the podcast, where they're done in one. You get a mystery, it's, first page, here's the mystery. You go through the entire investigative process, and at the end, there is a really satisfying ending.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I walked out of issues one and
the
four.
The end usually is him putting a name onto a gravestone.
Right. And it makes a nice framing point, and like I said, it's satisfying.
Uh-huh.
And so I really liked those two issues. I thought they were paced well. We've gotten to a point in comic books now, in modern comic books, where people have forgotten how to tell a satisfying 22-page story.
Sure, yeah.
And it's tough to tell a mystery in 22 pages, because you have to have the crime, you have to have the suspects, you have to have the evidence, and you have to have the reveal. All in 22 pages. I mean, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And to do it,
and you have to have the search.
Yeah, exactly. And you really need to have some sort of twist or red herring or something thrown in there as well, or else it's everyone's got it solved on page three.
Sure.
And Wade does a great job with that.
And not only that, but then uses panels to reveal a little bit about John Doe, like you said, with the fingerprint dusting and things like that. There's nice little touches. peppered into these stories with that as well.
Yeah, it, you know, I really thought that those two issues, issue one and issue four, were great. Uh-huh. And I, you know, those are, like Fell, those are the kinds of issues that when people say, you know, why do you like comics? Isn't it all just, you know, guys who wear their underwear on the outside? Those are the kinds of issues that you want to hand to people and go, well, you know, do you like a mystery? Here, read this. And, you know, you get a satisfying, you know, mystery in 22 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Issues 2 and 3 were a little different for me. And that was where I started to have some problems with it. Because, and it wasn't that they were linked together. It wasn't that it was a, you know, it was continued in the next story, that, you know, the next issue. That wasn't the problem for me. The problem for me was that it was a revenge story.
Uh-huh.
And it was a it was someone seeking revenge on John Doe.
I feel like one of the problems with that is that we're given a mystery character, and the problem with a mystery character is there's nothing to really get behind that mystery mm-hmm. character. And so I feel like the revenge story, and I think that this is where you're going with it, needed to be in, like, issue 15.
Right.
Or something way down the line when we've been revealed enough to know about John Doe and really get behind the character. But issue 2 is...
Yeah. It,
a bit premature.
Exactly. Because there, you know, yeah, there wasn't anything to latch onto with the character for us to really... like him. I mean,
or any history. Like, we right. needed some history. Like, why does this guy want revenge on him? Why? Like, there was no buildup. Like, it just seems like in issue 10 or something like that, where he could have had some battles against this person that wants revenge on him or something, you know, where the reader knows, like, oh yeah, that guy's got it out for him.
Well, you know, and we've got, you know, it is a nice nod because, you know, it does actually bring in a character from issue 1.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like this guy is just coming out of nowhere. But again, you know, the guy was from character, you know, the character was from issue 1, and now we're on issue 3, and that's the big reveal that, I mean, it's that kind of deal where it's like, really? We're dealing with a revenge plot in issue 3 from a character from issue 1? Are we really out of characters that soon?
Yeah.
And that was a little... Yeah, I mean, it just didn't work for me as well. I mean, I can understand why if Doe's entire point is to go and, you know, find justice for these unknown people.
Uh-huh.
I get that. I really do. And I can see how that would make, you know, people angry and scared, and that they would want to get revenge on Doe. But, man, to kind of waste it all right there by issue, you know, 2.
Well, I think I see what he was doing. He was wanting to string a story through all the issues, you know, mm-hmm. and there's probably going to be some fallout later on from this or whatever. But I felt like you said, it's premature. Like, it just shouldn't have been done right. that early. And there maybe could have been better ways to string these issues together.
Well, and you lose some of the emotional impact, not just of it with Doe, but because he has so few people around him that he trusts. And trust is a very loose word there. You know, mm-hmm. trust is that he actually meets with them. I mean, they know nothing about him either. And I don't think I'm spoiling anything here because it's revealed by the end of issue 2, that the way that this revenge plot sort of takes place is that some of these people that Doe trusts, or at least shares and meets with, inadvertently betray him.
Yeah.
And again, I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying that. Like I said, that's by issue 2. You know, and again, that does not have the same emotional impact as if we were on, say, issue 10 or 12,
mm-hmm.
where we've seen this relationship build up between these characters, and then they inadvertently betray him. That's a much more powerful piece than having it be the second issue. where you're thinking, you know, why would anybody have loyalty to this guy? Or wouldn't it be so simple if? Well, yeah, clearly it is so simple. It was by issue two.
Yeah.
And I think that was unfortunate because, again, you lose some of the emotional impact there.
I mean, the idea is that this is an ongoing series, right? Or that's was the, this the...
No, the idea is that this is an ongoing series.
Yeah.
Nothing has come out since then. I'm hoping that, you know, Mark Waid is now the editor-in-chief at Boom. I'm hoping that this will lead to more stories by Waid with the character. Because, like I said, issues 1 and 4... were so satisfying.
They really were, yeah.
And again, it for me, I mean, I hate to keep coming back to Fell, but I think it's because Fell just doesn't come out anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it scratches that itch for me to have that good detective mystery story in a reasonable size, in a reasonable time frame.
Sure. And I think it works well in a trade as well.
Mm-hmm.
I read Fell in the trade, and I think that it worked well because I'd read through one story, you know, one mystery or whatever, and then I'd set it down. Or
right.
If I wanted to, I could read two.
Yeah.
And I think that it worked well in a trade. It didn't have to be strung together
right.
by
you
one thread.
Yeah, you don't need the ongoing plot thread weaving through to have a trade. You could have a trade collection of individual issues.
Mm-hmm.
It works just fine. You know, we can go back to Warren Ellis again with Global Frequency. I mean, that was 12 issues where each one was an individual story and they had characters that would sort of come back and forth, but there was no overarching story. And it worked just fine.
Uh-huh.
Just like Potter's Field would have worked just great if it was 4 individual mysteries. You didn't need this
sure.
thread to tie it all together. What'd you think about the art on it?
It was very weird for me because there were certain pages that I really, really liked and
mm-hmm.
then certain that just sort of kind of got washed out with the darkness and the coloring of it.
Right.
But overall, I think that I really enjoyed it. There was just a couple of pages mm-hmm. that were really too dark and kind of washed out.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't have a problem with the art at all. It was the coloring.
Yeah.
That this desire to set the whole book at night, this desire to make it this gritty, noir feel detective story, really makes artists or colorists, you know, try to cram as many dark hues in there as possible.
Uh-huh.
And you end up getting a muddy mess at times, which
sure.
is unfortunate because I think, like you said, there were some panels and some pages in there that I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were others where there was just too many black lines in there to really figure out what was going on. And it didn't need to be that way. It wasn't that there were characters that should have been, you know, shrouded in mystery to kind of, you know, make their, you know, hide their identity or something. It wasn't that. It was just that the scene was just not lit well.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, I know that comics and movies are two separate mediums, but I think that there is some crossover in the sense that they're both visual storytelling mediums.
Yeah.
And I really think that colorists in particular, and to a lesser extent, you know, line artists really should look at movies and good movies in the genre that they're trying to do and look at how scenes are lit and put together.
Uh-huh.
You and I just talked to Jamie Rich about You Have Killed Me, which is a detective noir story. And one of the things that we were both very impressed with was that it was not a dark book.
Uh-huh.
It was lit well through the whole thing.
Sure, it was like a use of textures to convey darkness as opposed to dark tones.
Right, and I think that that's what I'm talking about, that paying attention to what really makes this dark or noir
sure.
as opposed to just dumping black on it or, you know, really cranking down the brightness in your, you know, coloring program. Because, you know, like I said, Potter's Field yeah, it takes place at night, but the whole thing doesn't have to be that dark where you can't make out the faces of the characters who are speaking.
Yeah.
You know, aside from the spots where you, I mean, there are some scenes in there where it is designed to be so black that you can't make out characters. That's one thing. I mean, I get that, but there are other scenes where it just didn't need to be.
Yeah, I agree.
The dialogue, I thought, was pretty solid, though. That I really felt like the characters were acting and interacting with each other.
Had distinct voices. Right. I agree, yeah.
And without getting into the cliches, because you've got, you have sort of these archetypes. I mean, you've got the you know, on-the-beat police officer, you've got the investigative reporter, yep. You've got the coroner, and you've got the prison security guard. I mean, these are kind of archetype characters, yep. And it would have been really easy to, you know, have them speaking in, you know, the you know, just cliched jargon. Yeah, but each one really had their own voice, their own story.
Uh-huh.
That didn't feel very expository. I mean,
it almost felt as if these were people first and then their jobs kind of came second, right. You know. It wasn't really as much of who they are. And I think that that's one of the things that Mark Waid did so well, because these characters are only in a single issue or maybe two.
Mm-hmm.
And you really get a sense for that person and how they're going to influence the story and what John Doe needs from them.
Right.
And that is one of the best things that Mark Waid did, was the characterization in this book, because there's so few pages with these people, mm-hmm. and he really gives you a sense of why they're there and why they're necessary for the story.
And I think that's probably why another reason why I didn't like issues 2 and 3 as much is that because there hadn't been enough time to build these other characters, it was like trying to cram so much characterization into it,
yeah.
Force things onto these characters that just didn't need to be there,
yeah.
Or that, you know, would have felt a lot better growing a little more organically and naturally, and yeah. So I think that was probably one of the reasons why I had it's not that I had a problem with them, I just did not enjoy issues 2 and 3 nearly as much as I enjoyed 1 and 4.
For your overall feel, though, how did you feel about this?
You know, I enjoyed it 50%. Well, probably more than 50%. I mean, like I said, issues 1 and 4 were fantastic. Those were great. If all 4 issues would have been like that, this would have been, you know, pretty close to a home run, aside mm-hmm. from the coloring issues in a couple of the pages. Like I said, issues 2 and 3 just weren't quite as good. And like I said, I think it wasn't that it was too ambitious. It was the wrong time to pull out that story.
I think that I enjoyed it more than you.
Mm-hmm.
The issues 2 and 3 bothered me less than you. So as a whole, I enjoyed this book, and I thought that it was a fairly successful book. I do agree that was pulled out a little bit too early,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't bother me nearly as much as it did you.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully, I'm not going to say if, when the next Potter's Field collection comes out, I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a compelling enough premise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm trying to think what it was, over 80,000 graves there. I mean, mm-hmm. it's one, the real Potter's Field is in New York is either the largest or one of the largest cemeteries, not just in New York, but in the country. You know, some 800,000, I mean, a ridiculous number of graves there. I mean, there's limitless possibilities, sure. Really. And that's one of the things that John Doe says.
Yeah.
And so, as long as Waid can keep coming up with compelling mysteries,
sure.
I'm there. I mean, yeah. I like the premise.
I felt like 2 and 3 also had, like, a very satisfying ending, even though the revenge plot should have been pulled out later. I still felt like at the end, like, it was really cool how it ended.
Yeah. Their reveal was satisfying. Yes, it was. I mean, and like I said, I mean, I think if I hadn't enjoyed 1 and 4 so much, you know, yeah. I think that 2 and 3 would have been just fine for me. It was that 1 and 4 were so good. So, you know, like I said, I'll be back for Volume 2.
There's definitely a lot of promise in this series.
There really is. And it's not just the main character. It's not just the John Doe. It's also the little bits and interactions with
it's
the supporting
Mark Waid's
cast.
Handling of the supporting cast as well. Yeah, right. I completely agree.
The one problem that I really had with this, though, was the price point.
Yeah.
The price point on this, I think, was, what, $26, roughly?
Yeah, well, this was released as a hardcover.
This was released as a hardcover. $26 for 4 issues, plus there is a script and some rough pencil layouts for a 5-page sort of promo story. And then a little bit of character design as well. And I thought the character design stuff was actually really interesting.
Yeah.
It was kind of a neat look at how do you make a mystery man be mysterious without being so over the top. And I thought that was kind of an interesting look at it. But $26 for basically 4 issues. I mean, if I had a problem with $17 for 4 issues... You know, with the special forces, $26 for 4 issues is just, I mean, that's just over the top. I'm sorry. You know, trade paperback, I would hope they would bring that down even below the $16 range.
Yeah, I agree. The price is a bit of a sticking point, but at the same time, this is a good story.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I don't know. I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the price point is a barrier to entry in this, which is unfortunate because the quality of the storytelling is very good. The premise is very good. The handling is good.
Mm-hmm.
$26 is not very good. And I, you know, unfortunately, it's going to be a barrier to it. I know that they're... You know, hyping this as the, you know, hard to find mini series. And again, it kind of falls into that whole thing with Special Forces that, you know, I'm sure the sales on it indicate that not every comic shop in America had it.
Yeah.
However, I'm pretty sure that most comic shops in, you know, a metropolitan area will have the back issues or eBay or, you know, something. You know, it's worth picking up the story. It really is. It's worth picking up the story. Or waiting for the soft cover to come out.
I agree.
Because hardcover at $26.95 just it doesn't work for me. I should probably note that one of the reasons why, or I'm sorry, it's $25, $24.99. So apologize for that. I should point out that one of the reasons why we're reviewing Potter's Field this week and. You'll be hearing more reviews of Boom books coming out from us in the next few weeks, is that I had made a comment on a message board about Boom books and my feelings about Boom books. And Chip Mosier, the VP of Boom, sent me a very nice email basically saying, you know, that he politely disagreed with my stance and challenged us, me in particular, but challenged us to read the Boom catalog basically and see if, you know, a wider exposure to the Boom titles would change my perspective on it. So you know, hey, we're going to take him up on it. He was kind enough to provide us with review materials, and so we're going to go and take a look through it. So,
sure, yeah.
So if you start to notice that we're reviewing more Boom titles over the next few weeks, it's simply because, hey, you know, we had a challenge laid down in front of us, and, you know, might as well take it. So thanks a lot to Chip over at Boom for laying it down for us, and you know, look forward to it, because like I said, this was definitely you know, I definitely enjoyed this book.
Yeah.
So look forward to more.
All right, you've been listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. And you can find us at www.stumptowntradereview.com.